Langdon sensed in Sienna's distant eyes that everything had changed for her this morning. Langdon's own life was in chaos at the moment, and yet he felt his heart going out to this woman. She saved my life, and I've ruined hers. They sat in silence for a full minute, the air between them growing heavy, as if they both wanted to speak, and yet had nothing to say. They were strangers, after all, on a brief and bizarre journey that had just reached a fork in the road, each of them now needing to find separate paths. "Sienna," Langdon finally said, "when I sort this out with the consulate, if there's anything I can do to help you, please."
"Thanks,"
she whispered, and turned her eyes sadly toward the window. As the minutes ticked past, Sienna Brooks gazed absently out the kitchen window and wondered where the day would lead her. Wherever it was, she had no doubt that by day's end, her world would look a lot different. She knew it was probably just the adrenaline, but she found herself strangely attracted to the American professor. In addition to his being handsome, he seemed to possess a sincerely good heart. In some distant, alternate life, Robert Langdon might even be someone she could be with.
"He would never want me," she thought. "I'm damaged."
As she choked back the emotion, something outside the window caught her eye. She bolted upright, pressing her face to the glass and staring down into the street.
"Robert, look!"
Langdon peered down into the street at the sleek, black BMW motorcycle that had just rumbled to a stop in front of Pensione La Fiorentina. The driver was lean and strong, wearing a black leather suit and helmet. As the driver gracefully swung off the bike and removed a polished black helmet, Sienna could hear Langdon stop breathing. The woman's spiked hair was unmistakable. She produced a familiar handgun, checked the silencer, and slid it back inside her jacket pocket. Then, moving with lethal grace, she slipped inside the hotel.
"Robert?"
Sienna whispered, her voice taut with fear.
"The U.S. government just sent someone to kill you."
Chapter 13. Robert Langdon felt a swell of panic as he stood at the apartment window, eyes riveted on the hotel across the street. The spike-haired woman had just entered, but Langdon could not fathom how she had gotten the address. Adrenaline coursed through his system, disjointing his thought process once again. "My own government sent someone to kill me?" Sienna looked equally astounded.
"Robert, that means the original attempt on your life at the hospital was also sanctioned by your government."
She got up and double-checked the lock on the apartment door.
"If the U.S. consulate has permission to kill you..."
She didn't finish the thought, but she didn't have to. The implications were terrifying.
"What the hell do they think I did? Why is my own government hunting me?"
Once again, Langdon heard the two words he had apparently been mumbling when he staggered into the hospital.
"Very sorry. Very sorry." "You're not safe here," Sienna said. "We're not safe here."
She motioned across the street.
"That woman saw us flee the hospital together, and I'm betting your government and the police are already trying to track me down. My apartment is a sublet in someone else's name, but they'll find me eventually."
She turned her attention to the biotube on the table.
"You need to open that right now."
Langdon eyed the titanium device, seeing only the biohazard symbol.
"Whatever's inside that tube," Sienna said, "probably has an ID code, an agency sticker, a phone number, something. You need information. I need information. Your government killed my friend."
The pain in Sienna's voice shook Langdon from his thoughts, and he nodded, knowing she was correct.
"Yes, I'm very sorry."
Langdon cringed, hearing those words again. He turned to the canister on the table, wondering what answers might be hidden inside. It could be incredibly dangerous to open this. Sienna thought for a moment.
"Whatever's inside will be exceptionally well contained, probably in a shatterproof plexiglass test tube. This biotube is just an outer shell to provide additional security during transport.
Langdon looked out the window at the black motorcycle parked in front of the hotel. The woman had not yet come out, but she would soon figure out that Langdon was not there. He wondered what her next move would be, and how long it would take before she was pounding on the apartment door. Langdon made up his mind. He lifted the titanium tube and reluctantly placed his thumb on the biometric pad. After a moment, the canister pinged and then clicked loudly. Before the tube could lock itself again, Langdon twisted the two halves against each other in opposite directions. After a quarter turn, the canister pinged a second time, and Langdon knew he was committed. Langdon's hands felt sweaty as he continued unscrewing the tube. The two halves turned smoothly on perfectly machined threads. He kept twisting, feeling as if he were about to open a precious Russian nesting doll, except that he had no idea what might fall out. After five turns, the two halves released. With a deep breath, Langdon gently pulled them apart. The gap between the halves widened, and a foam rubber interior slid out. Langdon laid it on the table. The protective padding vaguely resembled an elongated Nerf football.
Here goes nothing.
Langdon gently folded back the top of the protective foam, finally revealing the object nestled inside. Sienna stared down at the contents and cocked her head, looking puzzled.
Definitely not what I expected.
Langdon had anticipated some kind of futuristic-looking vial, but the content of the biotube was anything but modern. The ornately carved object appeared to be made of ivory and was approximately the size of a roll of lifesavers.
It looks old, Sienna whispered. Some kind of
cylinder seal, Langdon told her, finally permitting himself to exhale. Invented by the Sumerians in 3500 BC, cylinder seals were the precursors to the intaglio form of printmaking. Carved with decorative images, a seal contained a hollow shaft through which an axle pin was inserted so the carved drum could be rolled like a modern paint roller across wet clay or terracotta to imprint a recurring band of symbols, images, or text. This particular seal, Langdon guessed, was undoubtedly quite rare and valuable, and yet he still couldn't imagine why it would be locked in a titanium canister like some kind of bioweapon. As Langdon delicately turned the seal in his fingers, he realized that this one bore an especially gruesome carving. A three-headed, horned Satan who was in the process of eating three different men at once, one man in each of his three mouths. Pleasant. Langdon's eyes moved to seven letters carved beneath the devil. The ornate calligraphy was written in mirror image, as was all text on imprinting rollers, but Langdon had no trouble reading the letters. Saligia. Sienna squinted at the text, reading it aloud.
Saligia?
Langdon nodded, feeling a chill to hear the word spoken aloud. It's a Latin mnemonic invented by the Vatican in the Middle Ages to remind Christians of the seven deadly sins. Saligia is an acronym for superbia, avaricia, luxuria, invidia, gula, ira, and acedia. Sienna frowned.
Pride, greed, lust, envy, gluttony, wrath, and sloth.
Langdon was impressed. You know Latin.
I grew up Catholic. I know sin.
Langdon managed a smile as he returned his gaze to the seal, wondering again why it had been locked in a biotube as if it were dangerous.
I thought it was ivory, Sienna said. But it's bone.
She slid the artifact into the sunlight and pointed to the lines on it.
Ivory forms in a diamond-shaped cross-hatching with translucent striations. Bones form with these parallel striations and darkened pitting.
Langdon gently picked up the seal and examined the carvings more closely. The original Sumerian seals had been carved with rudimentary figures and cuneiform. This seal, however, was much more elaborately carved. Medieval, Langdon guessed. Furthermore, the embellishments suggested an unsettling connection with his hallucinations. Sienna eyed him with concern.
What is it?
Recurring theme, Langdon said grimly, and motioned to one of the carvings on the seal. See this three-headed man-eating Satan? It's a common image from the Middle Ages, an icon associated with the Black Death. The three gnashing mouths are symbolic of how efficiently the plague ate through the population. Sienna glanced uneasily at the biohazard symbol on the tube. Allusions to the plague seemed to be occurring with more frequency this morning than Langdon cared to admit, and so it was with reluctance that he acknowledged a further connection. Seligia is representative of the collective sins of mankind, which, according to medieval religious indoctrination, was the reason God punished the world with the Black Death, Sienna said, completing his thought. Yes. Langdon paused, momentarily losing his train of thought. He had just noticed something about the cylinder that struck him as odd. Normally, a person could peer through a cylinder seal's hollow center, as if through a section of empty pipe. But in this case, the shaft was blocked. There's something inserted inside this bone. The end caught the light and shimmered. There's something inside, Langdon said, and it looks like it's made of glass. He flipped the cylinder seal upside down to check the other end, and as he did so, a tiny object rattled inside, tumbling from one end of the bone to the other, like a ball bearing in a tube. Langdon froze, and he heard Sienna let out a soft gasp beside him. What the hell was that? Did you hear that sound? Sienna whispered. Langdon nodded and carefully peered into the end of the canister. The opening appears to be blocked by something made of metal. The cap of a test tube, maybe? Sienna backed away. Does it look broken? I don't think so. He carefully tipped the bone again to re-examine the glass end, and the rattling sound recurred. An instant later, the glass in the cylinder did something wholly unexpected. It began to glow. Sienna's eyes opened wide.
Robert, stop! Don't move!
Chapter 14. Langdon stood absolutely still, his hand in midair, holding the bone cylinder steady. Without a doubt, the glass at the end of the tube was emitting light, glowing as if the contents had suddenly awoken. Quickly, the light inside faded back to black. Sienna moved closer, breathing quickly. She tilted her head and studied the visible section of glass inside the bone.
Tip it again, she whispered, very slowly.
Langdon gently turned the bone upside down. Again, a small object rattled the length of the bone and stopped.
Once more, she said, gently.
Langdon repeated the process, and again the tube rattled. This time the interior glass shimmered faintly, glowing again for an instant before it faded away.
It's got to be a test tube, Sienna declared, with an agitator ball.
Langdon was familiar with the agitator balls used in spray paint cans, submerged pellets that helped stir the paint when the can was shaken.
It probably contains some kind of phosphorescent chemical compound, Sienna said, or a bioluminescent organism that glows when it's stimulated.
Langdon was having other ideas. While he had seen chemical glow sticks and even bioluminescent plankton that glowed when a boat churned up its habitat, he was nearly certain the cylinder in his hand contained neither of these things. He gently tipped the tube several more times until it glowed, and then held the luminescent end over his palm. As expected, a faint reddish light appeared, projected onto his skin. Nice to know a 208 IQ can be wrong sometimes. Watch this, Langdon said, and he began shaking the tube violently. The object inside rattled back and forth, faster and faster. Sienna jumped back.
What are you doing?
Still shaking the tube, Langdon walked over to the light switch and flipped it off, plunging the kitchen into relative darkness. It's not a test tube inside, he said, still shaking as hard as he could. It's a Faraday pointer. Langdon had once been given a similar device by one of his students, a laser pointer for lecturers who disliked wasting endless AAA batteries and didn't mind the effort of shaking their pointer for a few seconds in order to transform their own kinetic energy into electricity on demand. When the device was agitated, A metal ball inside sailed back and forth across a series of paddles and powered a tiny generator. Apparently, someone had decided to slide this particular pointer into a hollow carved bone, an ancient skin, to sheath a modern electronic toy. The tip of the pointer in his hand was now glowing intensely, and Langdon gave Sienna an uneasy grin. Showtime. He aimed the bone-sheathed pointer at a bare space on the kitchen wall. When the wall lit up, Sienna drew a startled breath. It was Langdon, however, who physically recoiled in surprise. The light that appeared on the wall was not a little red laser dot. It was a vivid, high-definition photograph that emanated from the tube as if from an old-fashioned slide projector. My God! Langdon's hand trembled slightly as he absorbed the macabre scene projected on the wall before him. No wonder I've been seeing images of death. At his side, Sienna covered her mouth and took a tentative step forward, clearly entranced by what she was seeing. The scene projected out of the carved bone was a grim oil painting of human suffering, thousands of souls undergoing wretched tortures in various levels of hell. The underworld was portrayed as a cutaway cross-section of the earth, into which plunged a cavernous, funnel-shaped pit of unfathomable depth. This pit of hell was divided into descending terraces of increasing misery, each level populated by tormented sinners of every kind. Langdon recognized the image at once. The masterpiece before him, La Mappa dell'Inferno, had been painted by one of the true giants of the Italian Renaissance, Sandro Botticelli. An elaborate blueprint of the underworld, the map of hell was one of the most frightening visions of the afterlife ever created. Dark, grim, and terrifying, the painting stopped people in their tracks even today. Unlike his vibrant and colorful Primavera, or Birth of Venus, Botticelli had crafted his map of hell with a depressing palette of reds, sepias, and browns. Langdon's crashing headache had suddenly returned, and yet for the first time since waking up in a strange hospital, he felt a piece of the puzzle tumble into place. His grim hallucinations obviously had been stirred by seeing this famous painting. I must have been studying Botticelli's map of hell, he thought, although he had no recollection of why. While the image itself was disturbing, it was the painting's provenance that was now causing Langdon an increasing disquiet. Langdon was well aware that the inspiration for this foreboding masterpiece had originated not in the mind of Botticelli himself, but rather in the mind of someone who had lived 200 years before him. One great work of art inspired by another. Botticelli's Map of Hell was in fact a tribute to a 14th century work of literature that had become one of history's most celebrated writings. A notoriously macabre vision of hell that resonated to this day. Dante's Inferno. Across the street, Bientha quietly climbed a service staircase and concealed herself on the rooftop terrace of the sleepy little Pensione La Fiorentina. Langdon had provided a non-existent room number and a fake meeting place to his consulate contact, a mirrored meet, as it was called in her business, a common tradecraft technique that would enable him to assess the situation before revealing his own location. Invariably, the fake or mirrored location was selected because it lay in perfect view of his actual location. Bientha found a concealed vantage point on the rooftop from which she had a bird's-eye view of the entire area. Slowly, she let her eyes climb the apartment building across the street.
Your move, Mr. Langdon.
At that moment, on board the Mendacium, the provost stepped out onto the mahogany deck and inhaled deeply, savoring the salty air of the Adriatic. This vessel had been his home for years, and yet now, the series of events transpiring in Florence threatened to destroy everything he had built. His field agent, Vientha, had put everything at risk, and while she would face an inquiry when this mission was over, right now, the provost still needed her. She damn well better regain control of this mess. Brisk footsteps approached behind him, and the provost turned to see one of his female analysts arriving at a jog.
Sir, the analyst said, breathless, we have new information.
Her voice cut the morning air with a rare intensity.
It appears Robert Langdon just accessed his Harvard email account from an unmasked IP address.
She paused, locking eyes with the provost.
Langdon's precise location is now traceable.
The provost was stunned that anyone could be so foolish. This changes everything. He steepled his hands and stared out at the coastline, considering the implications. Do we know the status of the SRS team?
Yes, sir. Less than 2 miles away from Langdon's position.
The provost needed only a moment to make the decision. Chapter 15.
L'Inferno di Dante,
Sienna whispered, her expression rapt as she inched closer to the stark image of the underworld now projected on her kitchen wall. Dante's vision of hell, Langdon thought, rendered here in living color. Exalted as one of the preeminent works of world literature, The Inferno was the first of 3 books that made up Dante Alighieri's Divine Comedy, a 14,233-line epic poem describing Dante's brutal descent into the underworld, journey through purgatory, and eventual arrival in paradise. Of the comedy's 3 sections, Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso, Inferno was by far the most widely read and memorable. Composed by Dante Alighieri in the early 1300s, Inferno had quite literally redefined medieval perceptions of damnation. Never before had the concept of hell captivated the masses in such an entertaining way. Overnight, Dante's work solidified the abstract concept of hell into a clear and terrifying vision, visceral, palpable, and unforgettable. Not surprisingly, following the poem's release, the Catholic Church enjoyed an enormous uptick in attendance from terrified sinners looking to avoid Dante's updated version of the underworld. Depicted here by Botticelli, Dante's horrific vision of hell was constructed as a subterranean funnel of suffering, a wretched underground landscape of fire, brimstone, sewage, monsters, and Satan himself waiting at its core. The pit was constructed in 9 distinct levels, the 9 rings of hell, into which sinners were cast in accordance with the depth of their sin. Near the top, the lustful or carnal malefactors were blown about by an eternal windstorm, a symbol of their inability to control their desire. Beneath them, the gluttons were forced to lie face down in a vile slush of sewage, their mouths filled with the product of their excess. Deeper still, the heretics were trapped in flaming coffins, damned to eternal fire. And so it went, getting worse and worse the deeper one descended. In the 7 centuries since its publication, Dante's enduring vision of hell had inspired tributes, translations, and variations by some of history's greatest creative minds. Longfellow, Chaucer, Marx, Milton, Balzac, Borges, and even several popes had all written pieces based on Dante's Inferno. Monteverdi, Liszt, Wagner, Tchaikovsky, and Puccini composed pieces based on Dante's work, as had one of Langdon's favorite living recording artists, Lorena McKennitt. Even the modern world of video games and iPad apps had no shortage of Dante-related offerings. Langdon, eager to share with his students the vibrant symbolic richness of Dante's vision, sometimes taught a course on the recurring imagery found in both Dante and the works he had inspired over the centuries.
Robert, Sienna said, shifting closer to the image on the wall. Look at that.
She pointed to an area near the bottom of the funnel-shaped hell. The area she was pointing to was known as the Malebolge, meaning evil ditches. It was the 8th and penultimate ring of hell, and was divided into 10 separate ditches, each for a specific type of fraud. Sienna pointed more excitedly now.
Look, didn't you say in your vision you saw this?
Langdon squinted at where Sienna was pointing, but he saw nothing. The tiny projector was losing power, and the image had begun to fade. He quickly shook the device again until it was glowing brightly. Then he carefully set it farther back from the wall on the edge of the counter across the small kitchen, letting it cast an even larger image from there. Langdon approached Sienna, stepped to the side to study the glowing map. Again, Sienna pointed down toward the eighth ring of hell.
Look, didn't you say your hallucinations included a pair of legs sticking out of the earth upside down with the letter R?
She touched a precise spot on the wall.
There they are.
As Langdon had seen many times in this painting, the tenth ditch of the Malebolge was packed with sinners half buried upside down, their legs sticking out of the earth. But strangely, in this version, one pair of legs bore the letter R, written in mud, exactly as Langdon had seen in his vision.
My God.
Langdon peered more intently at the tiny detail. That letter R, that is definitely not in Botticelli's original.
There's another letter, Sienna said, pointing.
Langdon followed her outstretched finger to another of the 10 ditches in the Malebolge, where the letter E was scrawled on a false prophet whose head had been put on backward.
What in the world? This painting has been modified.
Other letters now appeared to him, scrawled on sinners throughout all 10 ditches of the Malebolge. He saw a C on a seducer being whipped by demons, another R on a thief perpetually bitten by snakes, an A on a corrupt politician submerged in a boiling lake of tar.
These letters, Langdon said with certainty, are definitely not part of Botticelli's original. This image has been digitally edited.
He returned his gaze to the uppermost ditch of the Malebolge and began reading the letters downward through each of the 10 ditches from top to bottom.
C-A-T-R-O-V-A-C-E-R.
Quattrovasser? Langdon said. Is this Italian? Sienna shook her head.
Not Latin either. I don't recognize it.
A signature, maybe?
Quattrovasser?
She looked doubtful.
Doesn't sound like a name to me, but look over there.
She pointed to one of the many characters in the third ditch of the Malebolge. When Langdon's eyes found the figure, he instantly felt a chill. Among the crowd of sinners in the third ditch was an iconic image from the Middle Ages. A cloaked man in a mask with a long, bird-like beak and dead eyes. The plague mask.
Is there a plague doctor in Botticelli's original? Sienna asked.
Absolutely not. That figure has been added.
And did Botticelli sign his original?
Langdon couldn't recall, but as his eyes moved to the lower right-hand corner where a signature normally would be, he realized why she had asked. There was no signature, and yet barely visible along La Mappa's dark brown border was a line of text in tiny block letters. La verità è visibile solo attraverso gli occhi della morte. Langdon knew enough Italian to understand the gist.
The truth can be glimpsed only through the eyes of death.
Sienna nodded.
Bizarre.
The two of them stood in silence as the morbid image before them slowly began to fade.
Dante's Inferno, Langdon thought. Inspiring foreboding pieces of art since 1330.
Langdon's course on Dante always included an entire section on the illustrious artwork inspired by the Inferno. In addition to Botticelli's celebrated map of hell, there was Rodin's timeless sculpture of the three shades from the gates of hell. Stradinus's illustration of Phlegis paddling through submerged bodies on the river Styx. William Blake's lustful sinners swirling through an eternal tempest. Bouguereau's strangely erotic vision of Dante and Virgil watching two nude men locked in battle. Byrus's tortured souls huddling beneath a hail-like torrent of scalding pellets and droplets of fire. Salvador Dali's eccentric series of watercolors and woodcuts. And Doré's huge collection of black and white etchings depicting everything from the tunneled entrance to Hades to winged Satan himself. Now it seemed that Dante's poetic vision of hell had not only influenced the most revered artists throughout history, it had also, apparently, inspired yet another individual, a twisted soul who had digitally altered Botticelli's famous painting, adding 10 letters, a plague doctor,
and then signing it with an ominous phrase about seeing the truth through the eyes of death. This artist had then stored the image on a high-tech projector sheathed in a freakishly carved bone. Langdon couldn't imagine who would have created such an artifact. And yet, at the moment, this issue seemed secondary to a far more unnerving question. Why the hell am I carrying it? As Sienna stood with Langdon in the kitchen and pondered her next move, the unexpected roar of a high-horsepower engine echoed up from the street below. It was followed by a staccato burst of screeching tires and car doors slamming. Puzzled, Sienna hurried to the window and peered outside. A black, unmarked van had skidded to a stop in the street below. Out of the van flowed a team of men, all dressed in black uniforms with circular green medallions on their left shoulders. They gripped automatic rifles and moved with fierce military efficiency. Without hesitation, four soldiers dashed toward the entrance of the apartment building. Sienna felt her blood go cold.
"Robert!" she shouted. "I don't know who they are, but they found us."
Down in the street, Agent Christoph Bruder shouted orders to his men as they rushed into the building. He was a powerfully built man whose military background had imbued him with an emotionless sense of duty and respect for the command chain. He knew his mission, and he knew the stakes. The organization for whom he worked contained many divisions, but Bruder's division, Surveillance and Response Support, was summoned only when a situation reached crisis status. As his men disappeared into the apartment building, Bruder stood watch at the front door, pulling out his comm device and contacting the person in charge.
"It's Bruder," he said. "We've successfully tracked Langdon through his computer IP address. My team is moving in. I'll alert you when we have him."
High above Bruder, on the rooftop terrace of Pensione La Fiorentina, Bianca stared down in horrified disbelief at the agents dashing into the apartment building.
"What the hell are they doing here?"
She ran a hand through her spiked hair, suddenly grasping the dire consequences of her botched assignment last night. With the single coo of a dove, everything had spiraled wildly out of control. What had begun as a simple mission had now turned into a living nightmare.
"If the SRS team is here, then it's all over for me."
Bianca desperately grabbed her Sectra Tiger XS communications device and called the provost.
"Sir," she stammered, "the SRS team is here. Bruder's men are swarming the apartment building across the street."
She awaited a response, but when it came, she heard only sharp clicks on the line. Then an electronic voice, which calmly stated, "Disavowal protocol commencing." Bianca lowered the phone and looked at the screen just in time to see the comm device go dead. As the blood drained from her face, Bianca forced herself to accept what was happening. The consortium had just severed all ties with her. No links, no association.
"I've been disavowed."
The shock lasted only an instant. Then, the fear set in. Chapter 16.
"Hurry, Robert," Sienna urged. "Follow me."
Langdon's thoughts were still consumed by grim images of Dante's underworld as he charged out the door into the hall of the apartment building. Until this instant, Sienna Brooks had managed the morning's substantial stress with a kind of detached poise, but now her calm demeanor had grown taut with an emotion Langdon had yet to see in her. True fear. In the hallway, Sienna ran ahead, rushing past the elevator, which was already descending, no doubt summoned by the men now entering the lobby. She sprinted to the end of the hall and, without looking back, disappeared into the stairwell. Langdon followed close behind, skidding on the smooth soles of his borrowed loafers. The tiny projector in the breast pocket of his Brioni suit bounced against his chest as he ran. His mind flashed on the strange letters adorning the eighth ring of hell, Katrovasser. He pictured the plague mask and the strange signature. The truth can be glimpsed only through the eyes of death. Langdon strained to connect these disparate elements. But at the moment, nothing was making sense. When he finally came to a stop on the staircase landing, Sienna was there, listening intently. Langdon could hear footsteps pounding up the stairs from below.
"Is there another exit?"
Langdon whispered.
"Follow me," she said tersely.
Sienna had kept Langdon alive once already today, and so, with little choice but to trust the woman, Langdon took a deep breath and bounded down the stairs after her. They descended one floor, and the sounds of approaching boots grew very close now, echoing only a floor or two below them. Why is she running directly into them? Before Langdon could protest, Sienna grabbed his hand and yanked him out of the stairwell along a deserted hallway of apartments, a long corridor of locked doors.
There's nowhere to hide.
Sienna flipped a light switch, and a few bulbs went out, but the dim hallway did little to hide them. Sienna and Langdon were clearly visible here. The thundering footsteps were nearly upon them now, and Langdon knew their assailants would appear on the staircase at any moment, with a direct view down this hall.
"I need your jacket,"
Sienna whispered as she yanked Langdon's suit jacket off him. She then forced Langdon to crouch on his haunches behind her in a recessed doorframe.
"Don't move."
"What is she doing? She's in plain sight." The soldiers appeared on the staircase, rushing upward but stopping short when they saw Sienna in the darkened hallway.
"Per l'amore di Dio,"
Sienna shouted at them, her tone scathing.
"Cos'è questa confusione?"
The two men squinted, clearly uncertain what they were looking at. Sienna kept yelling at them.
"Tanto chiasso a quest'ora."
So much noise at this hour. Langdon now saw that Sienna had draped his black jacket over her head and shoulders like an old woman's shawl. She had hunched over, positioning herself to obstruct their view of Langdon crouched in the shadows. And now, utterly transformed, she hobbled one step toward them and screamed like a senile old woman. One of the soldiers held up his hand, motioning for her to return to her apartment.
"Signora, rientri subito in casa."
Sienna took another rickety step, shaking her fist angrily.
"Avete svegliato mio marito che malato."
Langdon listened in bewilderment. "They woke up your ailing husband?" The other soldier now raised his machine gun and aimed directly at her.
"Ferma o sparo."
Sienna stopped short, cursing them mercilessly as she hobbled backward away from them. The men hurried on, disappearing up the stairs. Not quite Shakespearean acting, Langdon thought, but impressive. Apparently a background in drama could be a versatile weapon. Sienna removed the jacket from her head and tossed it back to Langdon.
"Okay, follow me."
This time Langdon followed without hesitation. They descended to the landing above the lobby, where two more soldiers were just entering the elevator to go upstairs. On the street outside, another soldier stood watch beside the van, his black uniform stretched taut across his muscular body. In silence, Sienna and Langdon hurried downstairs toward the basement. The underground carport was dark and smelled of urine. Sienna jogged over to a corner packed with scooters and motorcycles. She stopped at a silver trike, a three-wheeled moped contraption that looked like the ungainly offspring of an Italian Vespa and an adult tricycle. She ran her slender hand beneath the trike's front fender and removed a small magnetized case. Inside was a key, which she inserted and revved the engine. Seconds later, Langdon was seated behind her on the bike. Precariously perched on the small seat, Langdon groped at his sides looking for hand grips or something to steady himself.
"Not the moment for modesty,"
Sienna said, grabbing his hands and wrapping them around her slender waist.
"You'll want to hold on."
Langdon did exactly that as Sienna gunned the trike up the exit ramp. The vehicle had more power than he would have imagined, and they nearly left the ground as they launched out of the garage, emerging into the early morning light about 50 yards from the main entrance. The brawny soldier in front of the building turned at once to see Langdon and Sienna tearing away, their trike letting out a high-pitched whine as she opened the throttle. Perched on the back, Langdon peered back over his shoulder toward the soldier, who now raised his weapon and took careful aim. Langdon braced himself. A single shot rang out, ricocheting off the trike's back fender, barely missing the base of Langdon's spine.
Jesus!
Sienna made a hard left at an intersection, and Langdon felt himself sliding, fighting to keep his balance.
"Lean toward me,"
she shouted.
Langdon leaned forward, centering himself again as Sienna raced the trike down a larger thoroughfare. They had driven a full block before Langdon began breathing again.
Who the hell were those men?
Sienna's focus remained locked on the road ahead as she raced down the avenue, weaving in and out of the light morning traffic. Several pedestrians did double takes as they passed, apparently puzzled to see a 6-foot man in a Brioni suit riding behind a slender woman. Langdon and Sienna had traveled 3 blocks and were approaching a major intersection when horns blared up ahead. A sleek black van rounded the corner on 2 wheels, fishtailing into the intersection, and then accelerating up the road directly toward them. The van was identical to the soldier's van back at the apartment building. Sienna immediately swerved hard to her right and slammed on the brakes. Langdon's chest pressed hard into her back as she skidded to a stop out of sight behind a parked delivery truck. She nestled the trike up to the rear bumper of the truck and killed the engine.
Did they see us?
She and Langdon huddled low and waited, breathless. The van roared past without hesitation, apparently never having seen them. As the vehicle sped by, however, Langdon caught a fleeting glimpse of someone inside. In the back seat, an attractive older woman was wedged between 2 soldiers like a captive. Her eyes sagged, and her head bobbed as if she were delirious or maybe drugged. She wore an amulet and had long silver hair that fell in ringlets. For a moment, Langdon's throat clenched, and he thought he'd seen a ghost. It was the woman from his visions. Chapter 17. The provost stormed out of the control room and marched along the starboard deck of the Mendacium, trying to gather his thoughts. What had just transpired at the Florence apartment building was unthinkable. He circled the entire ship 2 times before stalking into his office and taking out a bottle of 50-year-old Highland Park single malt. Without pouring a glass, he set down the bottle and turned his back on it, a personal reminder that he was still very much in control. His eyes moved instinctively to a heavy, weathered tome on his bookshelf, a gift from a client, the client whom he now wished he'd never met. 1 year ago. How could I have known? The provost did not normally interview prospective clients personally, but this one had come to him through a trusted source, and so he had made an exception. It had been a dead calm day at sea when the client arrived aboard the Mendacium via his own private helicopter. The visitor, a notable figure in his field, was 46, clean-cut, and exceptionally tall, with piercing green eyes.
"As you know," the man had begun, "your services were recommended to me by a mutual friend."
The visitor stretched out his long legs and made himself at home in the provost's lushly appointed office.
"So, let me tell you what I need."
"Actually, no," the provost interrupted, showing the man who was in charge. "My protocol requires that you tell me nothing. I will explain the services I provide, and you will decide which, if any, are of interest to you." The visitor looked taken aback, but acquiesced and listened intently. In the end, what the lanky newcomer desired had turned out to be very standard fare for the consortium, essentially a chance to become invisible for a while, so he could pursue an endeavor far from prying eyes. Child's play. The consortium would accomplish this by providing him a fake identity and a secure location entirely off the grid, where he could do his work in total secrecy, whatever his work might be. The consortium never inquired for what purpose a client required a service, preferring to know as little as possible about those for whom they worked. For a full year, at a staggering profit, the provost had provided safe haven to the green-eyed man, who had turned out to be an ideal client. The provost had no contact with him, and all of his bills were paid on time. Then, 2 weeks ago, everything changed. Unexpectedly, the client had made contact, demanding a personal meeting with the provost. Considering the sum of money the client had paid, the provost obliged. The disheveled man who arrived on the yacht was barely recognizable as the steady, clean-cut person with whom the provost had done business the year before. He had a wild look in his once sharp green eyes. He looked almost ill. What happened to him? What has he been doing? The provost had ushered the jittery man into his office.
The silver-haired devil,
his client stammered.
She's getting closer every day.
The provost glanced down at his client's file, eyeing the photo of the attractive silver-haired woman.
Yes, the provost said, your silver-haired devil. We are well aware of your enemies, and as powerful as she may be, for a full year we've kept her from you, and we will continue to do so.
The green-eyed man anxiously twisted strands of greasy hair around his fingertips.
Don't let her beauty fool you. She is a dangerous foe.
True, the provost thought, still displeased that his client had drawn the attention of someone so influential. The silver-haired woman had tremendous access and resources, not the kind of adversary the provost appreciated having to deflect.
If she or her demons locate me,
the client began.
They won't, the provost had assured him. Have we not thus far hidden you and provided you everything you've requested?
Yes, the man said. And yet, I will sleep easier if...
He paused, regrouping.
I need to know that if anything happens to me, you will carry out my final wishes.
Those wishes being?
The man reached into a bag and pulled out a small, sealed envelope.
The contents of this envelope provide access to a safe deposit box in Florence. Inside the box, you will find a small object. If anything happens to me, I need you to deliver the object for me. It's a gift of sorts.
Very well.
The provost lifted his pen to make notes.
And to whom shall I deliver it?
To the silver-haired devil.
The provost glanced up.
A gift for your tormentor?
More of a thorn in her side.
His eyes flashed wildly.
A clever little barb fashioned from a bone. She will discover it is a map. Her own personal Virgil. An escort to the center of her own private hell.
The provost studied him for a long moment.
As you wish. Consider it done.
The timing will be critical,
the man urged.
The gift should not be delivered too soon. You must keep it hidden until...
He paused, suddenly lost in thought.
Until when? The provost prodded.
The man stood abruptly and walked over behind the provost's desk, grabbing a red marker and frantically circling a date on the provost's personal desk calendar.
Until this day.
The provost set his jaw and exhaled, swallowing his displeasure at the man's brazenness.
Understood, the provost said. I will do nothing until the circled day, at which time the object in the safe deposit box, whatever it may be, will be delivered to the silver-haired woman. You have my word.
He counted the days on his calendar until the awkwardly circled date.
I will carry out your wishes in precisely 14 days from now.
And not one day before,
the client admonished feverishly.
I understand, the provost assured. Not a day before.
The provost took the envelope, slid it into the man's file, and made the necessary notations to ensure that his client's wishes were followed precisely. While his client had not described the exact nature of the object in the safe deposit box, the provost preferred it this way. Detachment was a cornerstone of the consortium's philosophy. Provide the service, ask no questions, pass no judgment. The client's shoulders softened, and he exhaled heavily.
Thank you.
Anything else? The provost asked, eager to rid himself of his transformed client.
Yes. Actually, there is.
He reached into his pocket and produced a small, crimson memory stick.
This is a video file.
He laid the memory stick in front of the provost.
I would like it uploaded to the world media.
The provost studied the man curiously. The consortium often mass-distributed information for clients, and yet something about this man's request felt disconcerting.
On the same date? The provost asked, motioning at the scrawled circle on his calendar.
Same exact date,
the client replied.
Not one moment before.
Understood.
The provost tagged the red memory stick with the proper information.
So that's it, then?
He stood up, attempting to end the meeting. His client remained seated.
No. There is one final thing.
The provost sat back down. The client's green eyes were looking almost feral now.
Shortly after you deliver this video, I will become a very famous man.
You are already a famous man, the provost had thought, considering his client's impressive accomplishments.
And you will deserve some of the credit,
the man said.
The service you have provided has enabled me to create my masterpiece, an opus that is going to change the world. You should be proud of your role.
Whatever your masterpiece is, the provost said with growing impatience, I am pleased you have had the privacy required to create it.
As a show of thanks, I've brought you a parting gift.
The unkempt man reached into his bag.
A book.
The provost wondered if perhaps this book was the secret opus the client had been working on for all this time. And did you write this book?
No.
The man heaved a massive tome up onto the table.
Quite to the contrary. This book was written for me.
Puzzled, the provost eyed the edition his client had produced. He thinks this was written for him? The volume was a literary classic, written in the 14th century.
Read it,
the client urged with an eerie smile.
It will help you understand all I have done.
With that, the unkempt visitor had stood up, said goodbye, and abruptly departed. The provost watched through his office window as the man's helicopter lifted off the deck and headed back toward the coast of Italy. Then, the provost returned his attention to the large book before him. With uncertain fingers, he lifted the leather cover and thumbed to the beginning. The opening stanza of the work was written in large calligraphy, taking up the entire first page. Inferno. Midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself within a forest dark, for the straightforward pathway had been lost. On the opposing page, his client had signed the book with a handwritten message. My dear friend, thank you for helping me find the path. The world thanks you too. The provost had no idea what this meant, but he'd read enough. He closed the book and placed it on his bookshelf. Thankfully, his professional relationship with this strange individual would be over soon. 14 more days, the provost thought, turning his gaze to the wildly scrawled red circle on his personal calendar. In the days that followed, the provost felt uncharacteristically on edge about this client. The man seemed to have come unhinged. Nonetheless, despite the provost's intuition, the time passed without incident. Then, just before the circled date, there occurred a rapid series of calamitous events in Florence. The provost tried to handle the crisis, but it quickly accelerated out of control. The crisis climaxed with his client's breathless ascent up the Badia Tower. He jumped off to his death. Despite his horror at losing a client, especially in this manner, the provost remained a man of his word. He quickly began preparing to make good on his final promise to the deceased, the delivery to the silver-haired woman of the contents of a safe deposit box in Florence, the timing of which, he had been admonished, was critical. Not before the date circled in your calendar. The provost gave the envelope containing the safe deposit box codes to Vianta, who had traveled to Florence to recover the object inside, this clever little barb. When Vianta called in, however, her news was both startling and deeply alarming. The contents of the safe deposit box had already been removed, and Vianta had barely escaped being detained. Somehow, the silver-haired woman had learned of the account and had used her influence to gain access to the safe deposit box and also to place an arrest warrant on anyone else who showed up looking to open it. That was 3 days ago. The client had clearly intended the purloined object to be his final insult to the silver-haired woman, a taunting voice from the grave. And yet now it speaks too soon. The consortium had been in a desperate scramble ever since, using all its resources to protect its client's final wishes, as well as itself. In the process, the consortium had crossed a series of lines from which the provost knew it would be hard to return. Now, with everything unraveling in Florence, the provost stared down at his desk and wondered what the future held. On his calendar, the client's wildly scrawled circle stared up at him, a crazed ring of red ink around an apparently special day. Tomorrow. Reluctantly, the provost eyed the bottle of scotch on the table before him. Then, for the first time in 14 years, he poured a glass and drained it in a single gulp. Below decks, facilitator Lawrence Knowlton pulled the little red memory stick from his computer and set it on the desk in front of him. The video was one of the strangest things he had ever seen. And it was precisely 9 minutes long, to the second. Feeling uncharacteristically alarmed, he stood and paced his tiny cubicle, wondering again whether he should share the bizarre video with the provost. "Just do your job," Knowlton told himself. "No questions, no judgment." Forcing the video from his mind, he marked his planner with a confirmed task. Tomorrow, as requested by the client, he would upload the video file to the media. Chapter 18. Viale Niccolò Machiavelli has been called the most graceful of all Florentine avenues. With wide S-curves that serpentine through lushly wooded landscapes of hedges and deciduous trees, the drive is a favorite among cyclists and Ferrari enthusiasts. Siena expertly maneuvered the trike through each arching curve as they left behind the dingy residential neighborhood and moved into the clean, cedar-laden air of the city's upscale West Bank. They passed a chapel clock that was just chiming 8 a.m. Langdon held on, his mind churning with mystifying images of Dante's Inferno and the mysterious face of a beautiful, silver-haired woman he had just seen wedged in between two huge soldiers in the back seat of the van. "Whoever she is," Langdon thought, "they have her now."
"The woman in the van," Sienna said over the noise of the trike's engine. "You're sure it was the same woman from your visions?"
"Absolutely."
"Then you must have met her at some point in the past 2 days. The question is why you keep seeing her, and why she keeps telling you to seek and find."
Langdon agreed. "I don't know. I have no recollection of meeting her, but every time I see her face, I have an overwhelming sense that I need to help her." "Very sorry. Very sorry." Langdon suddenly wondered if maybe his strange apology had been directed to the silver-haired woman. Did I fail her somehow? The thought left a knot in his gut. For Langdon, it felt as if a vital weapon had been extracted from his arsenal. "I have no memory." Eidetic since childhood, Langdon's memory was the intellectual asset he relied on most. For a man accustomed to recalling every intricate detail of what he saw around him, functioning without his memory felt like attempting to land a plane in the dark with no radar.
"It seems like your only chance of finding answers is to decipher La Mappa," Sienna said. "Whatever secret it holds, it seems to be the reason you're being hunted."
Langdon nodded, thinking about the word Quattrovasser, set against the backdrop of writhing bodies in Dante's Inferno. Suddenly, a clear thought emerged in Langdon's head. "I awoke in Florence. No city on earth was more closely tied to Dante than Florence. Dante Alighieri had been born in Florence, grew up in Florence, fell in love, according to legend, with Beatrice in Florence, and was cruelly exiled from his home in Florence, destined to wander the Italian countryside for years, longing soulfully for his home. You shall leave everything you love most," Dante wrote of banishment. "This is the arrow that the bow of exile shoots first." As Langdon recalled those words from the 17th canto of the Paradiso, he looked to the right, gazing out across the Arno River toward the distant spires of old Florence. Langdon pictured the layout of the old city, a labyrinth of tourists, congestion, and traffic bustling through narrow streets around Florence's famed cathedral, museums, chapels, and shopping districts. He suspected that if he and Sienna ditched the trike,
They could evaporate into the throngs of people. The old city is where we need to go, Langdon declared. If there are answers, that's where they'll probably be. Old Florence was Dante's entire world. Sienna nodded her agreement and called over her shoulder.
It will be safer, too. Plenty of places to hide. I'll head for Porta Romana, and from there we can cross the river.
The river, Langdon thought with a touch of trepidation. Dante's famous journey into hell had begun by crossing a river as well. Sienna opened up the throttle, and as the landscape blurred past, Langdon mentally scanned through images of the inferno, the dead and dying, the 10 ditches of the Male Bolge, with the plague doctor and the strange word, Quattrovasser. He pondered the words scrawled beneath La Mappa. The truth can be glimpsed only through the eyes of death, and wondered if the grim saying might be a quote from Dante. I don't recognize it. Langdon was well-versed in Dante's work, and his prominence as an art historian who specialized in iconography meant he was occasionally called upon to interpret the vast array of symbols that populated Dante's landscape. Coincidentally, or perhaps not so coincidentally, he had given a lecture on Dante's Inferno about 2 years earlier. Divine Dante, Symbols of Hell. Dante Alighieri had evolved into one of history's true cult icons, sparking the creation of Dante societies all around the world. The oldest American branch had been founded in 1881 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. New England's famous fireside poet was the first American to translate the Divine Comedy, his translation remaining among the most respected and widely read to this day. As a noted student of Dante's work, Langdon had been asked to speak at a major event hosted by one of the world's oldest Dante societies, Società Dante Alighieri, Vienna. The event was slated to take place at the Viennese Academy of Sciences. The event's primary sponsor, a wealthy scientist and Dante Society member, had managed to secure the Academy's 2,000-seat lecture hall. When Langdon arrived at the event, he was met by the conference director and ushered inside. As they crossed the lobby, Langdon couldn't help but notice the 5 words painted in gargantuan letters across the back wall. What if God was wrong?
It's a Lucas Trauberg, the director whispered. Our newest art installation. What do you think?
Langdon eyed the massive text, uncertain how to respond. His brushstrokes are lavish, but his command of the subjunctive seems sparse. The director gave him a confused look. Langdon hoped his rapport with the audience would be better. When he finally stepped on stage, Langdon received a rousing round of applause from a crowd that was standing room only. Meine Damen und Herren, Langdon began, his voice booming over the loudspeakers. Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome. The famous line from Cabaret drew appreciative laughter from the crowd. I've been informed that our audience tonight contains not only Dante Society members, but also many visiting scientists and students who may be exploring Dante for the first time. So, for those in the audience who have been too busy studying to read medieval Italian epics, I thought I'd begin with a quick overview of Dante, his life, his work, and why he is considered one of the most influential figures in all of history. More applause. Using the tiny remote in his hand, Langdon called up a series of images of Dante, the first being Andrea del Castagno's full-length portrait of the poet standing in a doorway, clutching a book of philosophy. Dante Alighieri, Langdon began. This Florentine writer and philosopher lived from 1265 to 1321. In this portrait, as in nearly all depictions, he wears on his head a red cappuccio, a tight-fitting plaited hood with ear flaps, which, along with his crimson Lucca robe, has become the most widely reproduced image of Dante. Langdon advanced slides to the Botticelli portrait of Dante from the Uffizi Gallery, which stressed Dante's most salient features, a heavy jaw and hooked nose. Here, Dante's unique face is once again framed by his red cappuccio. But in this instance, Botticelli has added a laurel wreath to his cap as a symbol of expertise, in this case, in the poetic arts. A traditional symbol borrowed from ancient Greece and used even today in ceremonies honoring poet laureates and Nobel laureates.